Hello, everybody. You know, looking back at the 2020 election, there was a bunch of stuff around that election that just didn't seem quite right. But it's kind of complicated, and most of us don't have the time or the, you know, the talent to dig into all the details. But today we're going to talk to somebody who did, and it's going to be a great conversation. Welcome to all of you who've joined us. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute here in Oakland, California. We're right across the bay from San Francisco, and we try and bring you a unique perspective on the issues of the day. I'm especially happy to welcome as our guest to this episode of Independent Conversations, our special guest, Molly Hemingway. Welcome, Molly, to the Independent Institute.
It's great to be back with you here.
It's wonderful to see you again. Yeah, we interviewed you here in person before COVID hit on your previous book that you wrote with Carrie Severino, but here we are again, and it's a lot of fun to see you. Now, not everybody may know who you are, but just bear with me, Molly, if you don't mind me bragging on you for a moment or two. So, Molly Ziegler Hemingway, you're the senior editor, one of the senior editors at The Federalist, right? And your last book was the one, Justice on Trial, the one that you wrote with Carrie Severino. People know your face because they see you on the Fox News Channel, and they see you sometimes with Special Report with Brett Baier in particular, or Media Buzz. I see you or your work all the time, Molly, in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, even in The Guardian, which is kind of nice, paying attention to you. And then most recently, you were awarded the 2021 Bradley Prize. So you're a Bradley Prize laureate, as they say these days. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
So looking at this book, Molly, which is Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and Democrats Seized Our Elections. This is the book. I invite you all to take a look at it, available from Regnery, available on Amazon. Could you have found, like, couldn't you have tried harder to find a more provocative title than Rigged?
Well, I actually think there are much more provocative titles, and I cared deeply about it being called Rigged. I thought okay. That was the right word to use to describe all of the machinations that were in place that affected the outcome of the election. So I really fought to make sure that was the title.
So you actually, in other words, I was joking, but you could have found a more provocative word or title than Rigged. Like, you could have had Theft.
Exactly.
Instead of Rigged, yeah.
And I think it's important, you know, people understood things weren't quite right with the election, but they need to know precisely what went wrong or what affected the integrity of the election. So I'm glad I researched it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great word because, you know, the more I read the book, the more I realized that it does capture the problems that you outline. Just to get a couple things out on the table before we start. Oh, and before I do that, let me just mention to all of our, we have a lot of attendees today, Molly. Which is great, especially since this is a private webinar. Let me just remind all of our participants and attendees that you can toss your questions in here that you would like Molly to consider answering. One friend has already put a question, so feel free to put questions into the Q&A or the chat box. I will see them, and you know, as the conversation proceeds, I will share those questions with Molly Hemingway. But as I say, to get a couple things out on the table, you know, Molly, when you say Rigged, it seems to me you mean something a little different from when former President Trump says the word rigged. He seems to mean that, well, sometimes depends on, you know, when you hear him, sometimes he seems to mean that there were specific places where actually there's documentation that individuals switched votes fraudulently and secretly and at a scale sufficient to change the outcome of the election. I mean, that may or may not be true, but certainly, that seems to be what he often means. When you say rigged, you mean something a little different, right?
So I would say that he frequently emphasizes the role of fraud in elections. And while fraud is a real thing that happens, and particularly happens when you intentionally flood the zone with tens of millions of mail-in ballots at the same time that you basically eliminate any means of determining whether those ballots are legitimately cast by a legitimate voter, I expanded the discussion so much more. I mean, he also talks about it in a broader sense, even if he uses more incendiary language. But what I'm talking about is that strategy of creating chaos and confusion with mail-in ballots, of making it spread out over months so that it's very difficult to observe what's going on, separating observers from the vote counting process. For me, the most dramatic thing that I cover in the book is the role that Mark Zuckerberg played in the private takeover of election systems, but also other things like international election observers don't think that you can have a free and fair election in a propaganda environment. So the problems we're experiencing with our media, which have become just out and out propagandists, are a threat to election integrity when they invent fake news, when they suppress real news. The role that tech companies play in controlling what people can learn about something, or, you know, the algorithmic game playing. So there are a million things that can go wrong with an election. Fraud is one of them, and it's very serious, but it's so much bigger than that.
Yeah, there's so much bigger. That's why I love the book. I noticed that you got reviewed in the Wall Street Journal last week. I think it was on the 15th. And in the Wall Street Journal review of your book, they noted a couple things where you seem to dissent from some narratives, just like kind of laying out what you're not saying before we get into what you are saying. So apparently you say in the book that the claims about Dominion voting machines being manipulated through programming are kind of hyped. Is that what you say?
So I talk about how, you know, usually when people are complaining about the integrity of voting machines, they're Democrats or they're the media. That's how it's been for decades. Republicans are kind of late to the game of complaining about voting machines and whether they're completely secure. And while it is true, absolutely true, that you need to make sure that they're not being interfered with and they are able to be hacked and all these types of things, I think the case I lay out in the book explains what we saw in 2020 so much better than allegations that to this point have not been well sourced about voting machine manipulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important. So, I mean, just trying to lay that out clearly, you're not asserting any of those ultra dramatic claims about Dominion companies' voting machines. You also don't seem to hold up Rudy Giuliani as sort of an exemplary legal figure in this situation. Is that right?
So the judicial battle, the legal battle was so complicated. And one of the things that was frustrating is that courts didn't intervene when they should have. There were really good cases that were working their way through both before the election and after, and courts just hate getting involved in elections.
They call it political questions and they try not to rule.
And that made a little bit more sense before we had this chaos and confusion of mail-in ballots where each county is interpreting things their own way. And there's just like, you don't even know who's voting, much less how they're voting. Mm. But I do tell the story of how one of these really good cases in Pennsylvania was harmed by the entrance of Rudy Giuliani. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got a lot to say for him, but he turned a case that was about disparate impact of voters, treatment of voters. So in one county, you had to follow the rules to have your vote counted. In the next county, you didn't. That's the kind of case that the Supreme Court has viewed kindly. That's what Bush v. Gore was about. But he comes in and he makes it again about fraud. Judges don't like it when you change what the case is about midway through. Plus, the facts weren't there to support that being a significant enough issue to warrant the court's interest in Pennsylvania. So I am critical of him in that case.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And again, helpful just to clarify, you know, where you stand on some of those hot button issues there. I mean, the background, of course, really struck me. The way you led into your argument in the book was a series of reminders. I didn't need a lot of reminding, but it was helpful to have them. You know, looking back at 2000, election was stolen when George Bush was ruled the winner in the Florida counting by the Supreme Court decision in Bush v. Gore. And then there was a few other elections before this last one, right, where people said unfair, whatever. Can you remind us a little bit of what prior election complaints said, like who were illegitimate presidents before?
Right. It's actually something that you've heard going back for a really long time in this country.
Yeah.
But the last time Democrats fully accepted a presidential election that they lost was 1988. Yeah.
Oof.
And in 2000, they famously said George W. Bush was selected, not elected. In 2004, you had senators and representatives challenging the results of the election because of their belief that Ohio voting machines had been rigged by Karl Rove to secure the re-election of George W. Bush. But none of that holds a candle to what we saw in 2016,
right,
when refusal to accept that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton led to a years-long, you know, just absolutely crazed denial of the integrity of the election. There were people winning Pulitzer Prizes for their belief that Russia had colluded with Trump to steal the election from its rightful victor, Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton herself said the election had been stolen from her. President Carter said that Russians had won the election for Donald Trump. And it wasn't just, you know, fringe people. It was one out of three Democrats refused to go to the inauguration of President Trump because they believed he was illegitimate. You had the special counsel probe. You had all these other probes. The entire media apparatus, the entire Democratic Party. And then when 2020 happens, even though it's the weirdest election any of us have ever experienced, with hundreds of changes in the middle of the game.
Oh, hundreds, yeah.
Then all of a sudden you weren't allowed to say a word about it. And I just thought that was extremely suspicious. And I knew I had to investigate it when that was how people responded.
Oh, for sure. Now, you know, you alluded to, I think in the first chapter, to this really stunning piece in Time Magazine, February 2021, by Molly Ball. You know, I never read that piece. And, you know, Time Magazine is a pretty mainstream place. And her title is The Secret History of the Shadow Campaign That Saved the 2020 Election. I printed it out after I saw your reference to it. I went into your footnotes and found that, you know, the URL. She says there's a secret history. This is so bizarre. This is before you wrote your book. The secret history of the 2020 election, Time Magazine says. It may sound like a paranoid fever dream, a well-funded cabal of powerful people ranging across industries and ideologies working together behind the scenes to influence perceptions, change rules and laws, steer media coverage, and control the flow of information. They were not rigging the election. They were fortifying it. And so there's this multi-page Time Magazine piece detailing remarkably, I had no idea that all these left-leaning groups with all sorts of money collaborated together deliberately and consciously to what they felt was fortify the election. In other words, to try and make sure that, well, I guess they wanted the outcome they liked, and none of them admitted that they were doing it unlawfully, but boy, they were going to exert influence, weren't they, Molly? And Time Magazine celebrated it. And you looked at the same data and you said, wait a minute, something's funny here, didn't you?
So I was so thankful that she wrote that article. Molly Ball is someone who's extremely close to Democrats. She was Nancy Pelosi's biographer. When she was saying, you know, they're not rigging, they're fortifying, they're rigging. Rigging is the actual right word to use. She talks about some of the money that was involved in this. It turns out that it was like literally close to $1 billion used to do all sorts of things, from overtake government election offices to suppressing news. One of the things she writes about in there is that they knew they had to control the freedom of information. So they were suppressing news that was helpful to Republicans. They were elevating news that was helpful to Democrats. They were changing all the laws and the procedures. They were flooding the zone with these mail-in ballots. I mean, it is what I wrote about in my book. And saying, you know, she has such a friendly turn, like they weren't doing anything nefarious. They were fortifying the election. Well, normally people say when you're meddling or getting involved in an election to control the outcome, rigging is the right word to use for that.
Yeah. In a sense, she almost teed you up, didn't she?
I was already writing the book at that time, and I was starting to look into these things, and I was worried that, you know, she just put it all out there in Time Magazine. Right. And what was fascinating about it is, as soon as people who were not happy with the outcome of the election read that, they said, see, we knew it. We knew that there was something like this going on. Mm-hmm. And so even with it all, it's not all admitted to. That's like the nicest
possible
version.
Right.
But even with it being admitted to, you have people saying like, oh, yeah, you're not allowed to ask any questions about the election. And it's right there in the cover of Time Magazine from a Democratic reporter.
Right. As a celebratory piece. Yeah, pretty stunning. Ooh. So just backing up a couple steps here, as I read the book, this book is not arguing that the tabulation of votes in polling places was secretly and fraudulently modified on a scale sufficient to change the outcome. But you are actually identifying some phenomena that are more troubling than that because they're more difficult to deal with. I mean, if you find that somebody dropped a load of ballots, I mean, you put them in jail, right? But what you have focused on are some things that are far more subtle, pervasive, and manipulative than simple, outright, old-fashioned fraud. So like the private money. Can we go there now, chapter 7?
Yes, but can I just first make one quick point? Yeah. While that is true, everything you say is true, I think it's important to know that the system has been changed to the point that you wouldn't know if there's something wrong.
I mean, oh, fraud, that's a good point.
Fraud is always difficult to detect, particularly conclusively. I mean, throughout history, the cases are rarely brought. They usually take years to develop. It's just a difficult crime to detect and prove. Mm-hmm. In this case, one of the things that's been happening, and you see this reported everywhere, is that observation is separated from the ballot counting procedure, mm-hmm. From the vote counting procedure. And so you hear that, I write about it in the book, how it happened in Philadelphia. They had to go to court so that Republican observers could be closer than a football field's length away from the vote counting process.
A football field, you can't see much. Yeah.
And, you know, think about what you're doing in observation. You're saying, okay, when they said that that was a signature match, or when they said that that was appropriately dated, and you can't even be anywhere near, it's just hard to have oversight. In Fulton County, which I also go into, in Georgia, which is the most populous county in Georgia, mm-hmm. that county is a disaster. I mean, it's been a disaster for a long time, but they actually told everybody they were wrapping up for the night. They didn't. They kept counting for another hour and a half with no oversight, no government
oversight.
I remember
watching some of the video.
Yeah, and so it's what you said is true, but it's also true that the absence of evidence doesn't mean that evidence of absence of fraud.
Yeah. What I was trying to be real precise. Your book is not asserting that claim, but your book doesn't deny it either, because we just don't know. And you also point out that the vast expansion, again, before we go to the private money thing, but the vast expansion of mail-in balloting, not in-person voting, has been identified before this election, before the latest controversies, by various study commissions as a vulnerable form of voting. Isn't that right?
Sorry, but I think I know what you're talking about. And I just want to say, yeah, Jimmy Carter had one of these commissions where they identified mail-in balloting as the most ripe for fraud.
Yeah, France
banned mail-in balloting because of fraud problems. New York Times and Washington Post openly discussed how mail-in balloting and absentee balloting was the primary means by which fraud was able to occur. And that it's able to occur this way doesn't mean it always does.
No, of course, right.
Come up with provisions. But of course, it stands to reason, there's almost no oversight. You know, all the things we did to make our voting system secure, like moving to private voting in private booths on one day with the government running, you know, the government printing the ballots instead of political parties. All these things are totally destroyed with crazy expansion of mail-in balloting without appropriate security.
I'm getting so many interesting questions. I'm tempted. I want to go to these questions, but first I had things I wanted to make sure I focused on. Chapter 7, the one about the Zuckbucks. The Zuckbucks, what a great term. Well, sometimes some people call them Zuckerbucks, you call them Zuckbucks. Mark Zuckerberg, if I'm getting the story right, felt that he had, well, I don't know what he felt, but he set out with his Chan Zuckerberg initiative to dispense, is it 350 million or 400 million?
Between two groups, $419 million.
$419 million. Two private groups whose mission was, I'm going to let you finish the sentence in a minute, but I think their mission was officially to help with adaptation of voting systems and processes in these unusual COVID contexts. And so, you know, that sounds like a pretty benevolent thing to want to do, but wow, $400 million. And then the $400 million, as it turns out, it wasn't simply made available even-handedly. It ended up becoming focused in certain highly desired voting districts, which happened to coincide with the voting districts where there were more Democratic votes available. How did that work, Molly? How could they do that? And what did they do precisely? Help us to understand.
So I will say that this was the part of the book that when researching, I just couldn't believe it. I thought it was I couldn't believe that this was allowed to happen.
I was stunned.
But yes, so the money was sold to the public as being out there to help with COVID protection. In fact, less than 1% of the funding went for COVID protection. That would be like personal protective equipment for volunteers or poll workers. Mm-hmm. This was money targeted not just to blue counties and blue cities, but blue cities and blue counties in swing states. 92% of the funds went to blue counties, but they really targeted blue areas of swing states so that they could flip states from Republican voting into Democrat voting. And the way they did this is they gave grants to these government offices, and then the government offices had to spend it on bringing in staff from left-wing organizations to essentially run the Democratic Party's get out the vote operation,
but from inside
the government offices. I mean, Republicans and Democrats both love to do get out the vote operations. It's expensive, right. It's difficult to find out who has voted already, who's, right. You know, how to get people to the polls. This was taking advantage of the information that governments have about who's voted and who hasn't. And the people were brought in to do everything from voter registration, ballot design, ballot translation, ballot harvesting, ballot curing, which is where you fix ballots that aren't going to be legally accepted unless they have some modification.
Like an address or something.
Yeah, ballot counting. And I mean, they did this in blue counties and swing states. Right. It was brilliant. And they targeted Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, right. Arizona, you know, states that had voted Republican 4 years ago and then switched into the Democratic column thanks to these funds.
Now, you were very careful in writing this chapter. I noticed that you pointed out that, in fact, some of the monies went to so-called red counties or jurisdictions as well. It wasn't as if it only went to blue, but your data suggested that on a per capita basis, not just on a per electoral district basis, but on a per capita basis, sometimes four, sometimes six times more money went to the Democrat-heavy voting districts than to others. I'm sure they had no idea, Molly, that their grants were going to be targeted in that way. I mean, it just happened, right?
So since I've written the book, there have been these researchers who have come public with some of their findings about this funding. And they say it's almost as if the funding was so effective in maximizing Democratic turnout in key areas that it's almost like they looked at what 2016 election patterns were and decided the funding based on that. Which they're not alleging that that's actually what happened, but that's essentially what happened when you're targeting these, you know, Philadelphia gets $10 million in Zuckerberg funding. The Republican county, you know, down the road gets $5,000. So they could say, well, we funded both Republican and Democratic counties.
And they did, but
not even close to the same amount. I mean, it's just like a fig leaf over the Republican funding. And I think Georgia is a particularly striking example. So there were the two groups that we mentioned, Center for Tech and Civic Life, Center for Election Innovation and Research. Those groups were used to funnel the money to the government offices. So one of those groups only gave like $285,000 to Florida, which was also, you know, a targeted state. The other group gave much more. Georgia, the two groups combined gave something like $45 million to Georgia. And you compare what happened in Florida, where it went from 1 point Republican to 3 points Republican between 2016 and 2020. Georgia, right across the border, very similar demographics in many cases, goes from 5 points Republican to 1 point Democrat. Not only does that affect the presidential election, it affects the control of the Senate. I mean, it was really smart and strategic thinking by these Democrats about how to, you know, it's possibly illegal, definitely unethical, totally unacceptable, but it was smart strategic thinking.
Very
about
smart.
How to take control of the U.S. government with one of the world's most powerful and wealthy men financing the operation.
Stunning, really. Mark Zuckerberg, in other words. But to be, and again, to be clear, and I don't want people to misunderstand you today. You're not saying in the book that you're saying that although it was ripe for illegal and fraudulent activity, you're not actually alleging that, because they didn't need to break any laws to have the desired effect. For example, this is not 1960 in Chicago. where there are reports, you know, that Democratic operatives would go through the city in certain neighborhoods and take, you know, $5, $10 bills, cut them in half, give the voter one half the bill, and then if the right candidate won, to get the other half of the bill. We're not talking about that kind of fraud or that kind of money. We're talking about all sorts of activities that on their surface sound really and probably are perfectly legitimate. I mean, voting offices do want more participation by the public. They do want their materials to be more easily understandable by the public. Those are all good things. But
so, I think it's a bit of an open question about whether what they did was legal or not legal.
It's kind of a
moot question because they did it. You know, it's already been done.
Well, it's not moot with regard to the future, though.
But and I will say that a lot of states have made changes to their laws to make sure that this can never happen again. This is not really a partisan issue. Nobody thinks that a private oligarch should be able to take over government election offices. I talked to people in Wisconsin about this because Wisconsin has cared about election integrity at a deep level. It's actually kind of impressive.
Well, that's part of its own progressive heritage. Yeah. I mean, there was a time when progressives are really hard on, you know, voting integrity.
Right. Their constitution says you have the right to vote, but you also have the right not to vote. So they're really careful about too much pressure to get people to vote. They'd say that voting in person on election day is a right. Other methods of voting are a privilege and that they're not necessarily, you know, always going to be.
That's very clear.
But I asked the Wisconsin people, like, how did you let this happen? And they're like, we had no idea that it was even possible for one man to take over our election system. And Wisconsin was the story I tell in there about how they actually drove the official government overseers out.
I saw that. She resigned.
Yeah. So, but the court challenges prior to the election, they said, we don't think this is partisan. It clearly was partisan. If it had been seen as partisan before the election, they may have been banned. You know, they might have been saying this was illegal. So I actually think those arguments of the legality of it being illegal are strong, but it kind of is more important moving forward to never let it happen again.
Yeah, well, that would occur by various jurisdictions and vulnerable states modifying their statutes to prevent this kind of private influence. I mean, to me, I think there's an intrinsic danger in having voting offices of local governments receive outside private, the mere fact of receiving money, whoever it's from, I don't care which rich guy it's from. I mean, it shouldn't be legal for these voting units of governments to receive private funding. They should get public funding.
You know, and this is an issue that has affected both left and right. You've seen some people on the right try to do private financing of border security.
And
it really is something where it's like, it's not healthy when things are breaking down to the point that there's an opportunity for this type of private funding. But it's something that affects both sides of the ledger.
In Green Bay, Wisconsin, that was one of the places where the guy who had been taken on at the recommendation of the grant mentors, as they somewhat ominously called them. The grant mentors recommended which organizations should be taken on as partners. And so they took on as a partner this one organization whose head eventually, Spitzer Rubenstein, he actually got the keys to Green Bay, Wisconsin's, the place where they're doing the counting, right?
I mean, it starts earlier with him getting information about who's voted early, who hasn't, so that they can exploit this information again for the Democratic get out the vote operation. He was targeting the five biggest cities in Wisconsin rather than the whole state. And yes, he had complete control over the operation, including, you know, guidance on vote counting, keys to the room where the ballots were held, you know, just something no private person not accountable to the voters should have the oversight of.
Another thing happened in Green Bay. I'm looking, I'm still in chapter 7. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff where you point out that there's this organization called the Center for Secure and Modern Elections, again, you know, indirectly funded by the Zuckerbucks, which is a left of center advocacy organization, as you point out. And they helped Green Bay, the municipality thereof, to develop Spanish language radio ads and geofencing to target voters in a predefined area. I mean, using those micro-targeting digital techniques to get at the voting populations that you want to really turn out. I mean, you're not telling them how to vote, you're just telling them to vote. But it sounds like old-fashioned kind of hyper-partisan but hyper-digital campaign get out the vote activities, but run through the government.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting in recent election history is that the Obama campaign was really effective at this micro-targeting, digital targeting of voters. And when they did it, they were praised to high heaven about their savvy. Donald Trump also did it in his winning campaign in 2016. And after that election, tech companies decided that they were really upset that they had somehow been used by a Republican. It was okay to be used by a Democrat, but not a Republican. And they start pushing back on this. But what you just talked about, what happened in Wisconsin, was a way of taking that digital targeting and bringing it into the government operation.
That's the part that bothers me.
And joining it with the partisan goal.
Let the campaigns campaign, you know, let them raise money and it's not tax deductible and whatnot, and it's not from the taxpayers. But when governments start doing it on this highly selective basis, it's troubling. Okay, so I'm turning the page almost literally to chapter 8, Molly. Here's how I would like to frame this and then let you respond to this. But it seems to me that one of the great virtues of America's electoral system is that it is highly decentralized and fragmented. And you know, there are 50 states, maybe 10,000 distinct voting jurisdictions. And this means that there are many points of vulnerability, but it also means that there's no one central lever that can be captured to produce the desired outcome. So if you want to produce an outcome, you have to have a more diffuse approach. We call that campaigning. But it has a lot to do with how information gets to voters. Long ago, the information climate in America, to use your phrase, I love that phrase, information climate, it was once also very decentralized. I mean, people lived far apart, there weren't national newspapers, there wasn't television, whatnot. It was very decentralized. Then by the mid-20th century, with the advent of television, it became very centralized. You know, one remark from Walter Cronkite could determine the opinion of millions of people in an instant, you know. And you're probably not old enough to remember Walter Cronkite, but I am. And you know, whatever he said on the evening news, it was, you know, the gospel truth to everyone, and everyone heard him at the same time. So very centralized. And then with the advent of the digital era, information started to become much more decentralized again. Many competing cable and internet, you know, options and voices, a kind of a healthy cacophony. Everyone said, oh, the digital age will prevent, you know, monopoly of information because there'll be so many different ways to get it. But then over the last decade, it seems like information climate in America has become centralized once again, so that their dominant information sources like Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, which may not have a single editorial voice, but they're the single choke point through which the vast majority of information flows. So it seems to me that you point out the ways in which this new re-centralization of information has turned out to be a great vulnerability, like all centralization is, and led to the constriction of knowledge and facts about that were relevant to the election. How were they constricted? How was information constricted? And what information was constricted, Molly?
Well, first off, I love the way that you talk about that, you know, going back between centralization and decentralization. It makes me think of Tocqueville talking about the importance of having a ton of newspapers to prevent the centralization of government or despotism through centralized control.
Tocqueville was ringing in my ears.
So yes, what we saw in the last few years was in fact sort of a central editorial voice that was engaged in a real strangling of freedom of information. And for me, you know, this started really concerning me a couple of years ago. This is actually one of the issues. This and the media is why I initially wanted to write about the book, because I think that not having freedom of information harms election integrity and harms the future of the republic, like whether the republic even exists. And, you know, there were so many different ways in which they did this: censorship, deplatforming, elevating certain things, you know, algorithmic manipulation. Mm-hmm. But a couple of years ago, I think the first time it really, really alarmed me was in the story of the first impeachment, when there was a government employee who was alleged to be a whistleblower, not technically a whistleblower, but that's sort of what we know him as. And he was a real person with a real name. And if you said his name, you actually got deplatformed. And Whoa. They took this to the extent that if you, like Senator Rand Paul, put his name on a whiteboard during the impeachment trial.
Yes.
And it was like we were all of a sudden transported to Soviet Russia, where the tech companies were like whitewashing the board so that you couldn't see it. They were literally like erasing the name out of there. Chief Justice Roberts refused to say the name, even though it was in a question from a U.S. senator, an official Senate.
Because what would have happened?
So I think, it's so mind-boggling to me. I don't understand their logic, except that they didn't want it shown that this was kind of like all an operation to take down the president, and so it was just really terrifying to me. And yet it just kind of continued with other forms of censorship, and then it culminates in the censorship of the Hunter Biden story, which is so important to the campaign, easily the most important campaign related story of 2020. And they just completely won't allow it to be shared or discussed on their platform. Mm-hmm. They ban the newspaper company, the New York Post, that actually publishes it. It's just an amazing and horrifying story that you never thought could happen in the United States.
I mean, when that first came out, you know, I'm sort of half in a, you know, half paying attention like most people. And it sounded so tawdry, you know, that there's this laptop and has icky pictures on it, and but it has these emails on it that seem to confirm that he and his father had met with foreign operatives, and implicit promises of influence and money were exchanged and so forth. But it all seemed so tawdry, and I said to myself, oh, it's just kind of some low life must have done this. And so I think that maybe for ordinary people sort of like me, it was easy to dismiss it because it just seemed kind of sleazy. And I don't like to read sleazy stuff. And so it was easier to dismiss it. But then now all the mainstream media have admitted that apparently it's valid information.
They haven't really admitted it. They kind of like lightly admitted it, and then they moved on. I mean, except for just a few days ago, there was this admission that Hunter Biden was involved in helping China secure cobalt mining in Africa in a way that is very disadvantageous to the United States. So all of his relationships with these foreign oligarchs is definitely of news interest to the American voter. The Biden family business is that you give money to members of the Biden family, and then it's not quite clear what you get in return. That's a good question for journalists to look into, because presumably the access to the president is related to taxpayer money, US foreign policy, or other issues that are of the utmost concern. But they knew that if people talked about that honestly, or talked to the named whistleblower, meaning Tony Bobulinski, a person who went out there with his own name and said, I personally talked to Joe Biden about the Biden family business, you know, they knew that would threaten their preferred candidate's electoral prospects. And so they just killed the story.
In doing so, again, kind of analogous to the other issues we were talking about a moment ago, those high-tech media behemoths were not necessarily violating any law, were they? I mean, they're private companies and people are using their service voluntarily. I mean, the American public didn't have to entirely constrict its information gathering to Twitter and Facebook, but it did. Well, not everyone, but the vast majority of people seem to be highly dependent voluntarily on this information source. So again, it's not clear to me that we're talking about a legal infraction, but there's a major ethical infraction here, at least, or more.
Yeah, I think there might be some legal remedies, particularly in the tech sphere, that might not be available currently in the media sphere. The media have certainly benefited from recent Supreme Court precedent, which gives them just like untold leeway to engage in unethical behavior or to lie. Like one of the things that happened after the Hunter Biden laptop story is that someone who was a main co-conspirator in the Russia collusion hoax, Natasha Bertrand, currently at CNN, I think, she came out with a story that said, oh, 50 intelligence community experts say that this is Russian disinformation. That wasn't true. It wasn't even like a fair write-up of what they were trying to mislead people into thinking. But there's sort of no recourse. You can participate in these lies, lying for years about whether Trump is a traitor. who colluded with Russia. And there are very few ways to push back. But there have been a bunch of federal judges who have said it is time to revisit New York Times versus Sullivan, which is the case issue that has caused so much damage here, to say that maybe there should be some more protection for public figures who are being defamed and so maligned by shoddy reporting.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I do think that if my suspicion is right, that there's very little illegality, but a lot of unethical going on here in this media molding and manipulating, I want to make sure that people ought to recognize, put it this way, people ought to recognize, I think, that something that's unethical may actually be worse than something that's illegal. There may be some wrongs that are of such a character that the law can't reach them, but they're especially bad, and we should condemn them. People should be ashamed of them, even if we don't make them illegal. In other words, worse than illegal, it may be immoral.
Yes, and I do think this also reminds us that we ourselves need to be good news consumers.
Yes.
We don't just like relish gossip and hearsay and anonymous sources just because it confirms
Amen.
Our priors, and that we need to not give shoddy media figures prestige that they have lost.
Right.
You know, one of the things that just concerns me greatly is we continue to operate as if we have the media of decades ago that at least tried to be somewhat balanced. You know, you see both parties choosing media figures as moderators of debate, even though media figures have long since, you know, been open about how they're not really media. They're engaged in propaganda.
And they're entertainers.
Yeah. And so we should hold them to a higher standard. And a lot of people already have decided no longer to trust corporate media. That's a good start. But you also need to support those people who are doing good journalism and beat them up.
Yeah, I mean, focus on facts. That's extremely important. And any time that anyone, even for a good cause, decides to shade the facts or conceal some, even if there are people I agree with, I just don't agree with that. We've got to resist that. We will only have credibility if we handle information honestly ourselves. Okay, so I'm going to turn now to a whole bunch of questions. Pent up questions from our participants in this web call. So, my favorite comment, of course, is from Miguel, who says, "Mr. Walker, you're rocking it with that bow tie." Thank you, Miguel. That's a great comment. however, here's another one. I'll read this to you. It seems like it's an important question. How do you square Colorado's well-respected mail-in voting system, which has been lauded by both GOP and Democratic election experts, with your view that such a system is rife with the possibility of fraud? Do you know anything about Colorado?
It's a great question. And it's actually one of the things that it is true that I am much more favorable toward day of in-person voting. And I think that's important, not just for security reasons, but because, you know, I interviewed Attorney General Barr for the book, and he said that having this like season of voting, which we used to have, by the way, and we moved away from 150
years ago, we had seasons of voting. Huh?
Well, we didn't all vote for the presidential contest on the same day.
Right.
And it did open things up to fraud. And so they moved it to one day, supposedly. California and other states moved us into this like season of voting spread out over the course of months. And he said that to him, this was like, if you are in a jury trial and you're told that you can render a verdict, you know, individually at any point in the trial, or you can vote on what the verdict is, it's better for us all to kind of come together to one day and as a people make a collective decision on one day with limited exceptions. We've always had limited exceptions. So that is true that is something I actually think would improve our system and take away some of these opportunities for problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I am definitely in the minority on that.
yeah.
know, people really seem to like seasons of voting where you don't know how many people voted for weeks. You don't know who they voted for weeks. So I'm on the outs there. But
I mean, ease and convenience seem to have become a much higher values than they used to be.
Yeah, but there are states that kind of slowly and deliberately moved to either universal or widely expanded mail-in balloting with broad bipartisan consensus about what systems would be in place to ensure the integrity of what was going on. It did take a long period of time. I'm actually from Colorado, so I know it took a long period of time. You know, Florida is one of those states with wide mail-in balloting. And they've done it with a lot of security to their system too. And so I think another issue where the vast majority of Americans agree is on strong and secure voter ID. I don't know, I mean, it's fascinating to me how much Democrats are fighting against this issue, because this is an 80-20 issue. 80% of Americans think there should be strong voter ID tied to whatever ballot is being cast. And so I think you just have to make sure the measures are there, that you're not creating a system. You know, you have to have clean voting rolls that are regularly cleaned. 10% of the country moves every year. A lot of people die. If you're just sending out ballots to anyone on your list, you're sending out ballots to like the same person
that's
who now lives in, or, you know, who's got addresses in three states. So they're just, you just have to balance your interests there, I guess.
Yeah. Here's another question. I am desperately trying to understand Ms. Hemingway's positions. It sounds like she wants much more public funding to get out the vote and other activities, B, restrictions on the use of money in politics, perhaps a reversal of Citizens United, and C, she wants much more in-person voting instead of mail-in ballots, despite decades of Republicans favoring mail-in balloting, so that she would advocate many more in-person voting places would be available starting weeks before the election. Is that right? Well, you're kind of addressing that, but
I don't think that person is desperately trying to understand anything. That doesn't sound like it's a reference to anything I've said or believed. But I do think we always should care. The Republic exists, you know, in part based on confidence in our elections. And that is an important bipartisan issue, that people need to trust the outcome of elections.
Yes.
And there have been years of an effort, you know, it is right now a Democratic Party effort, but both parties have had, you know, issues in the past, of trying to create chaos and confusion and expand the sphere of litigation. I don't think that's good for the country. I don't think that's good for civil discourse. I don't think it's good for us moving together as a people. And so it's important that this not just be shoved through to harm people's confidence in elections just because it gives short-term power to the Democratic Party.
Your last chapter, your epilogue, is called Consent of the Losers. Which you acknowledge is a very important principle. You're kind of getting at that now, are you not?
Yeah, I mean, winners tend to accept results of right. contests, whether it's a football game or an election. But you need to run the game in such a way that even the loser has confidence that they lost fair and square. That is not where we are right now. And I think that no one can deny that.
Looking again at some of these interesting questions, what do you think, this is Brian, he asked, what do you think of the recent New York Times report that New York City will likely approve non-citizens to vote in local elections there by year's end?
I thought it was really fascinating. That's just, you know, news out today, that, and that's something that's allowed in certain California jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. And mostly what it made me curious about was, how do they separate, you know, if that's their decision that they want to have non-citizens voting in local elections, what systems are in place to ensure that those people are not voting, you know, in state elections or national elections? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I imagine it is very hard to separate out the legal contest from the illegal contest. And one of the things that if it's legal for a non-citizen, because they say so, to vote in a local contest, doesn't mean it's legal for them to vote in the presidential election. And so how do you determine? Mm-hmm. So many of the problems that we see with election integrity are because Secretary of State's offices don't do a good job of helping people understand what they're legally allowed to vote on and what they're not. You know, people in one county are supposed to vote on this issue, but not in the other. So how you draw the lines is important. I don't have supreme confidence in New York's ability to manage all of that, or in California's, frankly.
Yeah, really. I got a question, which I think I can paraphrase. If there was this very extensive effort to do what you call rigging the election, which is to say all these diffuse and multifaceted ways of influencing and manipulating information, data, systems, and whatnot, how come it was so ineffective? I mean, by which the person means, you know, yeah, Biden won the presidency, but, you know, the Democrats lost their position in the House. They gained the Senate just by a bare. I mean, if they really wanted to do it, why didn't they do it? And the fact that they didn't really succeed except with getting the presidency, like, does that call into question your analysis?
Wasn't really successful except for determining who is president and who controls the Senate. I don't know if that's
seems important,
because that's actually really successful. But that's why I think my argument does a better job of explaining this than others that I've seen laid out. Because they were targeting blue areas of swing states, they weren't trying to switch House seats that were secure for Republicans. I mean, half the time people aren't even running legit candidates for the Republican Party in these blue areas. So it didn't have any effect on the House. And then it becomes kind of fascinating to see, wait a minute, the House actually moved more, you know, it was less Democrat, more Republican, which heightens the, you know, the sense that something wasn't quite right in 2020. People keep on saying, like, statistically, this is an anomaly. This Zuckerberg funding explains that anomaly, in my view, better than some of the theories out there about voting systems.
Yeah, that's a very good answer, a very specific answer, because I hadn't really thought that angle out carefully myself.
But again, Georgia being key, that's what gave them control, gave yes. Democrats control of the Senate. Right. And that's where they invested, you know, that's where they predominantly invested their money.
Yeah, I mean, some people rightly pointed out that Donald Trump told Republicans in Georgia maybe they should just, you know, abstain from voting because the whole thing was messed up. And that may have suppressed Republican turnout in that Senate election possibly. But that's another political question. Okay, please ask Molly why she thinks that not a single influential Republican has picked up the ball here and is doing anything to prevent this from happening next time.
So,
or is someone? Maybe someone is.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about what Republicans didn't do or what they are doing. And I would say that it is definitely true that Democrats have been on top of this for decades longer than Republicans have. Democrats have this highly funded operation. We didn't even talk about this, but one of the things I found very interesting is that the guy who ran the Russia hoax is a guy named Mark Elias. He's the one who worked as general counsel for Hillary Clinton's campaign. He hired the Fusion GPS guys who created the fake Russian dossier alleging yes. that Donald mm-hmm. Trump was a traitor. So Mark Elias is his name. He's also the guy who ran the effort to create chaos and confusion in the 2020 election by changing all of these laws frequently in an unconstitutional manner. You know, constitutionally, the legislature is supposed to handle election laws.
Per the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he would employ a sue and settle strategy. He'd sue a friendly state, Secretary of State, and get them to settle and agree to his list of demands. And so I just think it's fascinating that the same guy has been involved in so many things to erode confidence in our elections for the last several years. But he's highly funded. Democrats have put a lot of effort into this, a lot of coordinated effort, and Republicans just haven't. Now, part of that is because of their own history. They had been for nearly 40 years prohibited by law from being engaged in election day litigation and oversight, which is a crazy story I tell in the book about the like left-wing judge who kept them under a consent decree for 38 years. It took him dying for Republicans to be able to have wow. a role in election day litigation and oversight. But having said that, they just weren't on the ball like Democrats were, and they now are realizing it. But Republicans actually did have some effective litigation responses to this Democratic operation before 2020, in 2020, certainly after 2020. A lot of states have improved somewhat their laws. And I would say the most important thing is Republican voters themselves are understanding that election integrity is not just something that happens. They have to have a direct role, particularly as we expand from election day into election season. That means every day that they're counting ballots, you need to have people there who are watching. I mean, some of what we saw happen in Virginia, they were actually allowed to get away with it, but it was election observers weeks before election day who noticed that they were accepting ballots without the appropriate level of scrutiny. They lost the contest, but that the only way that we knew that was going on was because people were taking a more active role in and participating in the oversight of their elections. So it requires, you know, top level people. And you know, I've been talking to members of Congress and senators ever since this book came out. I know they're involved in it. Governors are involved. RNC is involved. So it's happening. It just needs more funding and grassroots support.
Michelle asks, what can an individual American citizen do to ensure that the vote is properly handled?
So I think that's like one of the great things about our system is that if you, you know, wherever you live, you can and should be involved in making sure that the election is being administered properly.
We're getting near the end of our hour. We could go on for a long time. A couple more questions. Can I ask you a couple more questions, Molly?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So here's a friend who says, the popular narrative is that the Republicans are supporting voting laws that are like Jim Crow. Speak to that, please.
This is actually enraged me because I think caring about the integrity of your elections is like a basic American thing. I mean, it is, Jim Crow was a real thing not that long ago. The Democratic Party completely disenfranchised Black voters in the South.
It was despicable.
It's horrible. And it's a real thing. And to compare voter ID to Jim Crow is just insane and racist. I mean, the idea that white people know how to get an ID, but people of other skin hues don't, is just like unbelievably racist. And that you've heard people say this, you know, on media, powerful politicians. But I do want to point out that I thought it was particularly despicable that when Georgia was trying to like lightly improve its voter integrity, and frankly, it wasn't even that impressive what they did, the president of the United States called on corporations to engage in an economic boycott of the state of Georgia. I just think that's despicable as, right, as in terms of being a president. And it was also despicable that they participated in that.
Oh, and both. Major, yeah. I mean, again, not illegal, but worse than illegal. Really despicable.
Major League Baseball, yeah, punished the people of Georgia by taking away the All-Star game and moving it to Colorado, a state, as a previous questioner noted, has stricter voter integrity than mm-hmm. Georgia does. And I thought that was awful. And it's like, you know, we've been screaming about fascism for 5 years, and the technical definition is about joining, you know, corporate and party control.
That is what
and
it
that's
means.
That's what we're experiencing with these corporations, with big tech, and they're joining with the Democratic Party to harm American freedoms. And I think it's just awful.
And in a way that constricts the ability of others to resist because of the flow of information and other matters are so tightly centralized, as we said before. Let's give this friend here, Kelly, the last question. She says, Molly, thanks for the book and staying on these affronts to our republic and therefore our freedoms. However, where do we have optimism about fixing this? Election integrity, tech oligarchs, the loss of independent media, failure of the courts to take action. Are we doomed to remain in our American version of Orwellian nightmare? Question mark. This is Kelly's question.
It's a good question, Kelly. And I do tend to be optimistic about these things. But I think, you know, we should first remember that the election in 2020 came down to 43,000 votes across three states. If those had, half of those had gone the other way, we'd be having a very different political outcome. The idea that you would give up at this moment on such narrow margins. I mean, people have fought much harder with much worse odds. And yes, it is scary what big tech is doing. Yes, it is scary what has become of our media. But there are tens of millions of Americans who agree that these are threats to our republic and our founding principles. You know, that freedom of religion and speech and the press are worth fighting for. Mm-hmm. And so I think the fact that more people are aware of these issues right now is huge. And you should take comfort in knowing that a lot of just normal Americans agree with you that the direction of the country is not good right now, and that people need to get involved. But I would just say, I do think getting involved at the local level is the most important thing. First and foremost in your own family, working on your own family and caring for your own family, schools, you know, local community, and broadening it out from there. Families really are the building block of society, and a strong family can take on, you know, quite a bit of bad things.
I'll say, yeah, good word, Molly. I'm so grateful to Molly Ziegler-Hemingway for joining us here on Independent Conversations from the Independent Institute out here in Oakland, California. Molly, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, it's been wonderful.
It's really great, and I encourage everybody to find this book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democratic and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. It's available from Regnery through Amazon, and I encourage you to take a look at it. And we wish you all the best, Molly, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.